I'd like to thank everybody for coming to my talk today. And today I'm going to talk about some of the benefits and challenges that we've faced irrigating our wastewater at Penn State. I'll start off with a little bit of a history. Back in the 1950s, the State College area and Penn State itself was growing rapidly, and it ended up causing a pollution problem in our local watershed, Spring Creek. That, in combination with a six-year drought leading to low water levels, and we actually had some accidental chemical spills in the university that had led to some fish kills. So a group of faculty members got together and started discussing alternatives to disposing the wastewater down Spring Creek, and they came up with the living filter idea. This is one of the original studies of the area. It's Penn State Studies number 23, and it looks at the initial conditions of the site. In 1963, we started irrigating our water, and it lasted for 20 years as a research topic. And then in 1983, we went to full-scale operations, and it was taken over by the Office of the Physical Plant. And I guess we can say today the rest is history, and it's still running, okay? So far, we've irrigated over 30 billion gallons of wastewater, and some of the challenges that we've come up with is the weather. You noticed on the way in today, it's kind of chilly. And in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania, we get sub-freezing temperatures much of the winter, and we irrigate all year round, so we're irrigating through sub-freezing temperatures. We also get a sufficient amount of rain. We get 30, 35 inches of rain every year, and we're adding to this with wastewater, so we have a lot of water for the soils to handle. With all that water, we have nutrients. Deepak just talked about phosphorus, but we've also had some problems with nitrogen, specifically nitrate in the water wells. Being the only place in Pennsylvania allowed to irrigate during the winter, we have a lot of strict regulations that we have to follow. Some of the concerns currently are some runoff and depressional areas within the system. We want to maintain our hydraulic capacity. The second talk from mine, Zach Larson, is going to be looking to see whether or not the hydraulic capacity of the soils has changed over time. And also, the big words today are emerging contaminants, and how does a system such as this react to emerging contaminants? With all of these challenges, we do have a lot of benefits. Groundwater recharge. We estimate around 80% of all water that we irrigate is recharged to the local aquifer. There is no more direct discharge into Spring Creek. We haven't put a drop in since 1983. That leads to no temperature increase into the Class A trout stream and no extra nutrients into the stream. We've improved our crop yields. I'll show some data on that. With that, all this improved treatment, very low energy requirements, not quite the energy consumption of reverse osmosis and ultrafiltration. And I think we're going to find out that a system like this reacts to emerging contaminants fairly well. Nuts and bolts of the factory. With the history, we researched since the 60s and full-scale since 1983. And right now we're running at approximately 2.7 MGD. And that is 365 days a year, except for Christmas when everybody goes home, it drops. But our permit allows us to add over 100 inches of water to any specific site there every year. And with our natural precipitation, that brings us up to somewhat of a tropical climate in respect to precipitation, at least. There are two sites. There's the game land site and the astronomy site. These total around 200 hectares. And that's about 3,100 sprinklers and about 100 kilometers of irrigation pipe. And we irrigate onto three different types of land cover. We have cropped fields, grass fields, and forested areas that we irrigate. University Park's down here. We're about a couple miles away from the actual irrigation site. If we look at the chemical characteristics of the wastewater, it is a traditional municipal wastewater. It's all from the campus. And the pH is relatively neutral. BODs are less than 10. Nitrate levels are now around 12. So it's a relatively clean water, but it can use some polishing, in which the soil will do. Now, we had some soils questions earlier. This is a Hagerstown, Hublersburg, Morrison soils group. that's in the area. It's that they're deep, well-drained soils. And actually, while we were installing monitoring wells back in the 60s, we found from those there's greater than 100 feet of soil, unconsolidated soil material in the area. So it's relatively deep, which is good for a living filter like this. We are underlain by limestone bedrock, karst topography in the area. So we have general rolling hills with depressional areas. And sometimes these depressional areas can cause us some troubles. You can see a picture on top over here. This is at the site. This is a Hagerstown soil, nice bright and red subsoil, which is characteristics of the Hagerstown. And down below, same site, maybe 50-100 feet away, depressional area, in which we have some grays, we have some redoxomorphic features in here. So we do have some period of saturation, although it's not characteristic for the well-drained Hagerstown and Hublersburg soils. So weather, we'll irrigate in the rain, we'll irrigate in the snow, whether it's 120 or minus 20. And actually the freezing temperatures presented some problems, and we had to change out our sprinkler heads because they were freezing up. And we ended up using the Rainbird sprinklers here, and now we can irrigate full time. As Deepak mentioned, there's only a couple hours of storage, so we don't have any other alternative. And it's quite a pretty sight out there after it's irrigated in minus 20 degree weather. Everything is covered with a nice coating of ice, and it's very pretty. All the water that we've been adding, there's nutrients in the water, specifically nitrate. And what we found is about after 10 years in the monitoring well system, we started to see some increases in nitrates. And actually, these increases went up above the 10 part per million drinking water levels. It caused some concern. The university was worried they don't want to be contaminating their drinking water with high nitrate levels from this. So they ended up reforming a wastewater advisory committee. And we had expertise in the cropping systems, geology, soils, forestry and engineering to make some operational management plans so that we can actually better manage the application of the wastewater and so on and so forth. We also implemented nitrification and denitrification at the wastewater facility. Here's a couple of graphs from the monitoring wells. They start off in the 90s at probably the peak level, and we can see over time that these levels have actually dropped pretty consistently, and we're starting to think that we're reaching somewhat of a steady state nitrate level in these wells, somewhere around the 5 to 7 part per million range. With monitoring for nitrate and worrying about the nitrogen, but on one hand, we also have to achieve a balance between nutrients and yield. We do farm a good portion of this area, and we want to make sure that the plants have enough nitrogen to grow and produce high yields. So we strive for a net zero addition of nitrogen. Whatever we add, we will take off. And we have to do extensive testing on the soil and plants to maintain this goal. And recently, as of last year, we started even side dressing with nitrates or with nitrogen to improve our yields to its full potential. The graph on the right actually shows yield from 2008, corn silage and wheat yield. And the blue bars are the irrigated area, their yields. And the green bars are Penn State non-irrigated. These are Penn State farms cropped in a similar way, but they're not receiving irrigation. And the red is the Pennsylvania average. So you can see, although we do receive a good amount of rain in Pennsylvania, the irrigation still helps to improve the yield. With all of the compliance with nutrients, we have a lot of regulations. And we have two parts to the regulations. We need to maintain compliance with those, and we try to influence them. We maintain a proactive report. We have monthly meetings with this group of faculty to advise the running of the system. And if we see problems, we try to fix the problems before we're told to fix the problems. We also have quarterly and yearly reports that are due with the monitoring programs just to make sure that nothing is getting away from us and out of hand. We also try to influence the regulations. Pennsylvania is currently developing some new regulations with the land application of wastewaters, and we've tried to make comments and suggestions to the DEP about this. And if there are issues that are raised, we try to address these through research. And the Office of the Physical Plant has actually provided funding for these types of issues throughout its running of the irrigation area, which is very nice and helpful not only to us but also to the state to see that this system will work. Everything is always changing, and we always are faced with new problems, and one of the new problems is the new era of pollutants, emerging contaminants. There was a session on that this morning. We're looking at estrogen at the site, and it's not too uncommon to see headlines such as these anymore in the news. Below a sewage outfall, you'll see male fish having female body parts, having egg sacs, and so on and so forth. So it's becoming a problem that we want to make sure we can keep a handle on. There are different forms of estrogen that we're looking at, and 17-beta estradiol is one of the forms that is commonly excreted. 17-alpha ethanol estradiol is the birth control pill. Most of those end up degrading into estrone, and that's what I've been currently looking at in the soils at the area. It's a very tricky type of extraction to do. I've tried a number of different ones, and this one seems to work the best. You take a 20-gram sample of soil and add sodium azide water in there to prevent any type of microbiological degradation of the estrogen, and you add 60 milliliters of ethyl acetate, will actually pull the estrogen off of the soil. You shake it overnight, remove 50 mils of that acetate, and you evaporate that down, and then you have tandem mass spectrometry analyze that. And I found that my extraction is around 60% efficient, which is pretty common with the literature. What we found is we also analyzed it in the wastewater, and the levels are around 1.75 nanograms per liter, between 1 and 2 nanograms per liter, common in the literature. And over on the right is the graph of the soil concentrations of estrone. And what we see is from 0 down to 48-inch cores I took, and I sampled throughout that depth, we do find concentrations of estrone, and it's from the 0 to 1 nanogram per liter, or nanogram per gram of soil. And it's interesting that we've actually found it down this far. If we do calculations, we shouldn't be finding it down quite this far in the profile. This is something that we're looking at. These concentrations were actually 3 weeks after the last irrigation event, so it is persisting in the soils during that period of time. And there was 2 inches of precipitation naturally falling on the area between the last irrigation event and from when I took the soils for extraction. So that might explain the lower concentrations in the surface as compared to the more elevated concentrations in the subsurface. We're continuing to look into the estrone concentrations, and we'll be looking at different types of emerging contaminants also. We're also going to try to maintain compliance with new regulations that are be coming out. We continue to monitor the soil quality. We don't want this area with all the 130, 140 inches of precipitation that it receives, both natural and through irrigation, to turn into a large wetland area. And to help conquer some of this, we're actually going to implement water reuse on campus for the steam plants and in the wintertime so that we don't have to irrigate as much water. And finally, just in closing, I just wanted to say that while I was talking, we've irrigated over 20,000 gallons of water at Penn State. More than 15,000 gallons of that will be aquifer recharge for us. And we've had this additional tertiary treatment provided by the soil without a huge energy input. So I'd like to thank you. And
how often do you irrigate the
hotland? We irrigate an area, we can irrigate it twice a week for a period of 12 hours each time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have runoff?
We do have runoff. We're not. It is tricky. In some areas, no matter what type of irrigation you do, you're going to end up having some runoff. The definition of runoff, though, is not well defined within the state.
Thank you, Chairman. Do you have problems with silicity and salinity in the soil?
I think, actually, I'll wait to answer that question. Zach Larson, in the next couple presentations, is going to talk about that. He on the same site. And so.
Thank you.